In this episode of The Full Nerd, we talk about ethics and mini PCs, but not the ethics of mini PCs. Welcome to episode 298 of The Full Nerd podcast, PC World's premier podcast about PC hardware and PC building. I am your fill-in host, Adam Patrick Murray. On the line, I've got Brad Charkas. Hello, Brad Charkas.
How's it going, man? It's been a few weeks since I've been on here, and this is my favorite part of each week, so I'm ready to go.
Yeah, everyone in the chat thought that you were ignoring them, but it's just not true.
Oh, no. I am overworked, and we're trying to hire people, so I'm trying to get them hired so I can be on here more.
There you go. I'm glad to have you. Speaking of glad to have you, glad to have Gordon here. Hello, Gordon. Hey. Live from what? Where are you? Which bridge is this? Doesn't look familiar.
It's the Defiant behind me. It's a 3D render by an artist that I found. It's really nice.
Nice. So I like it. Well, hopefully your communication holds while you're in deep space. And you've got the four little buttons on your thing. So what is the four?
Isn't that the four pips? Technically a captain, I think.
Oh.
But whatever.
Oh, crap.
It was the ill-fitting cosplay costume that I ordered from Wish AliExpress. It's all from the same factory, but... If you ever watch fan-based Star Trek YouTube videos, they always fit like this because nobody can have them tailored.
Well, I guess in this show I'm going to have to refer to you as Captain Gordon.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Oh, Captain, my Captain. Oh, wait, wrong movie, wrong show.
Speaking of fitting, I'm about to run in a charity cancer race at the beginning of next month.
Ooh, nice.
And the theme is dress up as your favorite superheroes for a local thing. I'm going to get a blue spandex suit and go as ultra fat and chubby Dr. Manhattan. I cannot wait for that.
Nice. Well, yeah, maybe you'll wear it on the show.
Maybe.
There you go. So we have a very special guest I'm excited to have on the podcast the first time, Russ from Retro Game Core. Hello, Russ.
Hi, good morning. I'm so happy to be here. I'm actually a little bit nervous, you know, just hearing about PC World for the past 40 years. Then, oh yeah, just come on the podcast.
No, it's going to be fun. And I said this in the pre-show. I think I've told you probably every time that we've chatted, but I'm not lying when I say that you're one of my favorite YouTube channels out there. If you don't know, Retro Game Core, CORPS, like you cover handhelds, you cover emulation, you cover... mini PCs, all this kind of stuff. And I just, every time a video posts, I'm just like, okay, well, I got to save this one because I got to get back to it ASAP. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Glad to have you on the podcast. And one of the reasons, you know, to have you on the podcast is actually you're going to be doing some work with us. So covering some mini PCs here on the PC World channel. So I'm excited to see how that grows. So look forward to some of that coverage. But today,
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't
I'm
know that?
Excited about that.
Yeah.
Looking forward to seeing you, Russ.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it as well. It's so cool, the idea of, you know, making new reviews and content like without the like Retro Game Core name attached to it, and just kind of going and doing something different. So super excited about it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that I've always tried to do on this channel, and obviously, you know, it's been big with Gordon and Brad, and, you know, bringing people together inside the PC world, you know, to coin a phrase. And when I think of mini PCs, I mean, you're for me at least, you're one of the experts out there that I turn to for fair and honest opinions. So glad to have your opinions. I'm also glad to have Willis Lai's opinions while he's controlling the verticals and horizontals.
Are you sure?
it's true.
Hello, internet. Hello, everyone. Happy Tuesday.
Yeah. And it is a happy Tuesday. I'm not going to get into too much preamble because we got a lot to talk about. We got two big topics, so we're going to dive straight into it. The first one, very serious, about ethics. Now, I think, you know, we all come from different walks of life. Gordon, you know, you actually went to school for journalism back when, a while ago?
A long time ago. And I think the saying is don't let your, in all newsrooms is don't let your kids grow up to be journalists.
There you go. And I have no experience or background in journalism. I've, what I've learned, I've been able to learn from from the fine folks here on PC World. So I think we got we all have a lot of different opinions and kind of, you know, ways to look at ethics and how we kind of cover topics and stuff like that. And we always like to talk about it. I think it is something we talk about on the show a lot. We like to bring it up and make sure people understand where we're coming from, or maybe just ethics in general and how things should be approached. But there has been an inflection point recently, which is the reason why I think, Gordon, you wanted to kind of touch on this subject. Why don't you give people a little background of what's been going on in the tech sphere?
Yeah, so this really leans into reviewers. Everybody here has experience reviewing hardware and software, I'm sure. This all kind of blew up recently because, you know, a very famous YouTuber, MKB, did I get that right?
MKBHD, Marquez
MKBHD. That HD always throws me because it's like, I'm sure he regrets that. Like, HD, what in the world is that like?
Because he was in HD. It was the new thing.
Yeah, so, but I mean, he reviewed the Fisker Ocean electric car that was in his opinion, terrible. It was a fiasco. He reviewed it, and then, you know, a couple months later, you know, Fisker basically is running out of money and is likely to file bankruptcy. But the thing that really seemed to piss people off recently at him, some people anyway, not his fans, it was his review of the Humane Pin, which basically, if you watch Star Trek, it's the equivalent of, where the hell is this thing? It's equivalent of a communicator badge pin using AI to create a post phone world. If that sounds like something really cool for the 24th century, yes, because Marquez basically said this is the worst thing I've ever reviewed so far, and the head, you know, pretty much slammed it. And a lot of people got kind of aggro, thinking that because of his reach, he's a gigantic YouTuber. He's got, like, I don't know, 18 million subscribers. It's unfair and irresponsible because of his reach, he could snuff out what is essentially a startup. So this is Humane. It's a first product. They've been building this thing since 2018. The thing basically runs really hot. It's really slow. It doesn't pair with your phone at all. And basically, in his opinion, and I encourage you to watch his video because I actually think the review was pretty even keeled. He basically says it does everything terribly. Like, it doesn't do much. And he was the focal point of a lot of anger on Twitter. People just saying, you're killing this company. You have to be more responsible. And then people, of course, also rushed to his defense. The reason why I wanted to talk about this is because Hardware and Box recently on their podcast, by the way, go listen to their podcast. It's a great podcast by the boys down under. They talked about the whole thing, like, for reviewers, you know, what's it like being a reviewer and whether they thought it was fair to pile on, you know, on him that way. And, you know, I don't want to come out here to defend a fellow hardware reviewer because I feel like, you know, that a lot of people just think we're going to defend each other because we're all sort of in the same camp. But I do think the review was fair, you know, and again, he gets to call it the way he thinks. You know, it's him. He's the one who has the hardware. He's the one who got to test it. If he had those problems with the car or with the Humane Pin, I think it would have been wrong for him to softball it. And honestly, if you watch the review, I think it was pretty fair because he does talk about the promises of the product. He talks about, you know, what it could do. And frankly, I was a little more impressed that it worked as well as it did in his video. So overall, I thought it was very fair, but I do think it's really good to talk about it because a lot of people don't understand what reviewers do. They don't. Oftentimes, we get people saying, just because you do an unbox or you talk about the product, like, they'll say, "Oh, great review." It's like, no, it's not a review. We're just talking about it. We just unboxed it. So I think there's a lot of topics to talk about. What do you all think? Do you think? To me, the big thing is, if you are that big, you have the footprint of, you know, one of the largest tech YouTubers out there. Is it irresponsible for him to step on a product with a headline that says "worst product I've ever reviewed"?
Yeah,
I have thought.
Yeah, lots to dig in here for sure.
Do you want to go first, Russ? I want to give the fresh guy a chance.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's I watched the review and I like Gordon thought it was pretty even keeled. I mean, he spent a good amount of time, you know, just focusing on what the product could do before even getting into his feelings and opinions and experience with it. And I think that's difficult if you're trying to do a good review, especially if you know it's going to be negative out of the gate. And so I think from a review standpoint, it was great. But man, about the whole like responsibility of, you know, someone who's so big and having the influence and whatnot. He didn't go and sneak into the factory and steal that thing. You know, they sent it to him. And so they must have known he was going to review it. And so they have to kind of take that in stride and make sure that their product is ready for a review and all of the things that come with that, better for worse. And so he did a pretty good rebuttal afterwards talking about, you know, do reviewers kill companies, you know? And so I think that's the thing, is the product. And so that's my big take on it too, is he was just being honest and using that credibility he's established over the past, whatever, 15 years he's been a YouTuber.
Right. I think we wouldn't even be in this place if it wasn't an AI pin. Like if you go and look at this whole controversy, it's funny because it wasn't just Marques Brownlee. Every reviewer, with the exception of one that I could see, thoroughly blasted this thing. Said, hey man, it sounds cool on paper, but this is trash. Nobody should pay $700 plus $20-something a month for this. The people who got really upset were venture capitalists and people fueling the AI buzz. I think Humane got in front of its skis here. They've raised something like $250 million. They're former iPhone designers and stuff like that. They were trying to make a big splash, being the first to market with something like this, because if you can just say AI somewhere in your product, like venture capitalists will shovel money.
Somebody's knocking at your door with a truck full of money.
Yeah, but the problem is to make a big splash, you got to have a good product. Marquez's rebuttal video, I think, summed it up really well. Like, we don't work for these companies. Although I technically work for my parent company, PC World and IDG, I don't even consider myself working for them. I work for the internet, the people, however you want to phrase it. Like, our job is to objectively or subjectively, hopefully as objectively as possible, there's always going to be some bias, but review these things and tell you, hey, is this worth your money or not? And I think Marquez's review and a bunch of other reviews, you know, get that point across. Most people should not buy this. Those reviewers aren't killing the company. Releasing a bad product is what hurts that company. And the part that I also found interesting was the flip side. I forget the exact name of the website, but Ray Wong did a very positive review of the AI, Humane AI pen, and he wound up getting a lot of harassment online over it, which I find unfortunate because he was doing his own thing. He was like, you know, most reviewers are out there looking at this from a product. Should you buy this as a product and reviewing it that way? Whereas Ray Wong's review was looking at it as that, but more AI optimism focused, like think of what this could be, which isn't personally the way that I review things. I think you should only buy stuff based off what's available right now, not future promises. But, you know, that's a useful insight to have, too. And for everyone to jump on him just as bad as they jumped on Marques Brownlee, I think there's a lot of interesting things around these.
Yeah, that is unfortunate because the vast majority of reviews were fairly negative toward the Humane pin. To come out and say something positive, then you have people, you know, jumping on your head because they think, oh, you're in the pocket of these companies. You're shilled is standard issue, you know, internet response of everybody. So that's unfortunate as well.
It is, and he didn't handle the feedback very well. But
oh, really?
I think the thing with product reviews, especially for us for tech, it might be different for something more artistic, but we're semi-fortunate in the fact that a lot of the stuff that we are evaluating is fairly objective. Like, there is subjectivity involved. You're like, hey, you know, I can't see this light very well in the light, and it's kind of slow. I don't know. I just don't like the vibe. That's good feedback to have in there. That's more subjective. But overall, like, we're here reviewing the products. You get the exact same product. Anyone else can take it out of the box and say, hey, what the heck was Brad talking about? He's, you know, none of this what he said is true. So yeah. I don't know where I was going there, but it feels like a tempest in the teapot almost.
You know, yeah.
I would even add that I think with every review, you know, I've done, I don't know how many at this point, 500 on my channel. With every review, you're basically putting yourself on the line because the truth is going to come out eventually. And so you get an early access to a device and, you know, you're doing whatever review you can on it. If you were just way off base, that truth will come out at some point. And, you know, and so it's always a challenge for me as a reviewer. If I'm going to be doing something negative, I spend three times as much time on it because I'm like, I got to make sure I've got my ducks in a row here, because at some point people are going to have this out in the world. And then that's going to be like the mass, like kind of understanding of how this device works. And so I have to nail that as much as I can to really give people an idea of what to expect when they're buying something. And so that's always what I focus on there. And yeah, the idea that somebody can kill a company just because they're, you know, saying something that's unobjectively, like, not part of the full review, you know, that they're just using part of their own subjective terms without really looking at the facts of it, it doesn't make sense to me, because the truth will always come to light over time.
Well, and like Gordon has always told me, that now that I'm, you know, starting to get into benchmark stuff, is that, like, hey, that the numbers are the numbers. The numbers don't lie. You put out how you ran the numbers, and I do think how you test things can be subjective, right? Like, what settings do you pick? You know, what cooler did you put on it? But at the end of the day, that's all still a data point, and here are the numbers you got from that data point. There's no, yeah, somebody else could do the same exact thing and theoretically get that same data point. You know, and but then there's the interpretation of what that means as well, that can be somewhat objective or subjective in my mind. But, like, yeah, Gordon, I think it's harder for, maybe you can talk about the differences between like a CPU review and this human or this AI pin, right? Because that's, you know, people aren't like benchmarking it necessarily, but it's, you know, one is like, you got a lot of data points that we run benchmarks on. The other one is a little bit more experiential. How do you balance that?
Yeah, no, it's fortunate because we live in the part of hardware where we have benchmarks, and, you know, benchmarks generally don't lie. They can be obviously bent to fit a narrative, but I think we've all done that where you get a CPU or GPU or any or system or anything. It's under a deadline, and then the deadline lifts and you really, really hope you're not out on the weeds by yourself. And it has happened to me, and you feel pretty stupid sometimes. You wonder what you did wrong. But the nice thing about having benchmarks is it just kind of tells you if you did something wrong and that, like, oh, I really kind of screwed up here. What the hell did I do wrong? And, you know, I will tell you that one time that it happened to me in print, I had to go back and, like, I had to update the BIOS. I didn't do that, and it was a long, long, long time ago, and it screwed up my results. And you feel really dumb, because we generally don't talk to other hardware reviewers. I don't do it because I don't want to sort of pollute my own view of hardware, and also I also don't want to talk to other people because I don't know, how do I know if they have the hardware, right? Like, if I'm under an embargo on a new product, I can't just go talk to somebody unless I know absolutely sure that they have one. I can assume they have it, but I technically can't talk to anybody else about it. So I don't. So you basically go out blind and you hope you don't screw up. And again, benchmarks, they, you know, a Cinebench or a Blender, it is what it is. It doesn't really change that much, except for hardware configurations. But with something with the Humane pin, it is definitely more subjective, right? Because it could be like, oh, I can live with the latency because, like, again, that one person you talked about, Brad, they said, oh, actually, I see the promise here. I really do see the promise here of this Humane pin. The concept is good. Obviously, it's $700. It's not for anybody. It's a toy for somebody who just has money to throw away. But if you see promise in that, and then maybe there is a post-phone, post-screen future, then that's your opinion. Whereas, you know, MKB was like, no, this is not anything that anybody should really buy, it sounds like. So that kind of sucks. And I do want to point out one thing. Humane has actually been very, very fine with it. You know, it's not like, you know, I'm sure we've had this response in the past where there are some hardware companies that send you something for review you come out and you basically say, yeah, nobody should really buy this. It's got a lot of flaws. Here's the problems with it. And those companies freak out. And then they want to jump on your head and they get very defensive. And then it gets into this back and forth battle. Humane has not done that. They've actually been pretty classy externally. I'm sure internally at their office, they have a dartboard with his face on it, and they are all just taking their turns throwing darts at it. I understand
that.
You don't
know that, but
believe me, I'm sure it's like people are going to be pissed. But publicly, they've been very, very fair, and they've been like very classy about it. And I think they've handled it fine. It's like, you know, thanks for the feedback. We're still working on it. So, you know, I think that should be pointed out. But because I will say that is not the response from some companies. I have a really funny story about that. If anybody wants to know, I can tell it later.
Interesting. Well, Russ, I feel like for handheld specifically, it's kind of a middle ground. There is benchmarking to be done. You actually do have factual numbers of testing, but then a lot of the usability side can be very subjective. There's plenty of handhelds that I've used where I was just like, I don't really like the feel of it in my hand, or it's too heavy. And it's like, who cares what the benchmarks say? I don't like that product. How do you go about, you know, weighing the two?
Yeah, it's always a problem for me. I consider myself to be an experiential reviewer. So I don't actually will throw up charts and graphs and stuff like that. I usually wait for others like Carrie from the Fox like to do his because I'd rather trust his authority on that and then focus on the things that I'm good at, which is really talking about the look and the feel and the experience of owning something. And that has gotten me in hot water a couple of times, you know, in terms of missing something like Gordon was talking about. And that's always the worst feeling, you know, and trying to come back from that and figure out how you can just kind of explain how that happened and where we're going and that kind of stuff. So it always takes time, you know. But yeah, it's always hard. And I think a handheld is different than like a PC. With a PC, you buy it and you're really looking at the specs and whatnot, because you're going to get your own keyboard, you're going to get your own mouse and your monitor, you know, all those things that are the experience of using a PC are going to be different for everybody else, because you have so many different ways of enjoying that. Whereas with a handheld, there's only one way to do it, you know? And so that's really one of the things I focus on in my reviews is like, you know, I spend 20 minutes of a 40-minute review before I even turn the device on, just talking about what it's like, you know, what are the good and the bad, the buttons, all those little things. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot more subjectivity and experiential kind of focus with my handheld reviews. And that's a lot of it is because it is a more experiential product. So, yeah.
Well, and to go back to one of the things we were talking about, a lot of people specifically are mad at Marquez for the headline. They might agree that the actual review itself they can kind of understand, but the headline itself is just a bridge too far. There's talk about like clickbait. Is it clickbait? Is he being too mean? You know, is it really the worst product he's ever reviewed? Is he allowed to say that? Brad, what if somebody on staff wanted to come with that headline, how would you work around
if
it?
If someone wanted to come with that headline, I would be all for it if they can back up their experience, which is exactly what Marquez did in his video. There are two aspects at play here. One, like, clickbait sucks, but you got to try to make your headline as catchy as possible, because to get your opinion out there and to have people view your stuff, that headline is what gets them. I'm a firm hater of, you know, this one thing happened, you won't believe what happened next. Like, I hate that kind of stuff. But I feel like a headline like, this is the worst product I've ever reviewed, coming from Marquez Brownlee, says a lot and gets the point across, and it's totally A-okay. And if you don't want to get saddled with that headline, don't saddle us with products like that.
Well, he did also couch it by putting at the end "so far," which for me, I was like, okay, well, I don't know exactly why he put that, maybe to soften the blow a little bit or something.
But give him a chance to do it again.
Yeah, right. There you go. the worst product I've ever reviewed again so far.
But headlines are important. Like, they really, there's an art to them. The clickbait, you know, over the top part of that sucks. The people who just go off of pure lizard brain stuff like that. I think you should get nugget of information, you know, talk about what makes this so exciting. What are we actually talking about? Stuff like that. But you need to make it as catchy as possible, because unless people see that and are intrigued enough to click on it, then, you know, you did all that work for nothing. I'm sure Marquez spent a ton of time testing this thing. Look at all, look, and money. Look at the production value of that video. And the Humane AI pin is not anything that anybody in the real world has name recognition of yet. So if you put a Humane AI pin in that video, nobody would click on it. But saying this is the worst product I ever reviewed, that'll get folks to click on it. And it's also true. So I can get what he was doing there, and I don't have an issue with it, actually.
Gordon, the headline, I mean, I've heard you tell me before that, like, words matter, right? That, you know, you definitely have to think about the headline when it comes to that stuff. I don't feel, me personally at least, that it was in the realm of clickbaity or anything like that. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on it.
You know, I will say it did feel, again, if you actually watch the video review, the entire video review, don't just skip through it and, you know, pick out parts and then try to come away from something. Watch the entire review. Again, I thought it was very fair. He definitely pointed out a lot of the shortcomings of it. But it's interesting to me. I did feel there was a little bit of a disconnect because maybe I'm used to people going at a little harder, because when you say it's the absolute worst thing ever, it feels like it's going to be nothing but 45 minutes of trashing the product. But it was like, it actually felt like there were some positive things said about it, because he sort of front loaded it by saying what the product was supposed to do. And that's, for me, it did feel a little disconnected. Whereas, you know, when you say worst product ever, this doesn't sound like you think it's the worst product ever. Or I think maybe it's just, he probably doesn't get inflammatory, I'm guessing. I haven't watched a billion of his videos, but I'm guessing he doesn't really wear it on his sleeve. He's not that kind of reviewer that is really going to, like, you know, take that knife out and jam it in their back about 50 times because they feel like they have that opportunity. So it did feel, I could understand why people would go like, I don't get this. The headline is worst ever. I was expecting it to be a lot worse, but this is like, yeah, if you're some rich person with $700 to throw away, whatever, but, you know.
Plus so, $30 a month.
Plus $30 a month. Yeah, I thought there was a little bit of disconnect there. So I could understand how some people would say that it didn't the head didn't match the story. And I will say, in the old days, newspapers, you didn't have any control. You handed in your story. Somebody in the copy desk wrote a headline that would fit in two columns, and that was it. And then same thing in the magazine days. And then and if you want to get worse, there's those, if next time you go through the supermarket, look at if there's any magazines left in the city you live in, look at the headlines on the cover of the magazine. There are total magazine clickbait tricks that every editor in chief of every magazine uses to get people to try to pick up that magazine and flip through it. And oftentimes those clickbait magazine headlines don't really match the actual reviews or stories inside. And I understand why, because they're made to sell the story just to get people to pick it up. So it did feel a little kind of funky in that way. But, you know, again, also, he's not the kind of person that's just going to, like, steam coming out of his ear and he's going to be screaming for 45 minutes into his webcam about it. So,
well, I think one of the other problems that is out there is that a lot of people will just take the headline of anything and maybe not watch the video and be like, oh, okay, well, you know, I got the idea of what he said in the video or the article based off the headline, so I'm going to go yell about it. Is there any way for us to deal with people who don't actually read or watch the content and just get the headline?
No. There's nothing you can do about that. People who just want to assume and start spouting off based off of headlines are making their own decisions on how to live their life.
I always think of like on Twitter, I'll like maybe you'll repost one of the videos that we did or the article with the video in it, and I'll go to repost it, and Twitter gives that little thing of like, hey, you didn't actually click on it. You sure you don't want to read this before you repost it? And I'm like, well, it's not for me because I know the video, but yeah, I can imagine.
I like that they do that though.
Yeah. I don't know if it works though. I do wonder like how many people do then like, oh, you know what? I guess I should go and read it.
It worked on me before.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go.
I have a question for all of you. Cause there's a lot of people that assume that reviewers love negative reviews. Like we like to write negative reviews because it easily makes something clickbaitable. It gets outrage, feeds the algorithm. That's kind of like the classic question. What do you all feel about like writing negative reviews? Do you really like, do you like love to write negative reviews and just kind of like jump on a product's head?
I can start with that. Yeah. So yeah, I hate making negative reviews, not necessarily because I'm trying to like shield a product or anything else like that, but I just don't like bringing that negative energy into the world. Like I made a channel to be excited about new products and show the things I'm excited about. And I think that MKBHD is similar in that way, in that he shows the things that interest him. And so making a negative review, it feels unnatural for me, and I kind of have to work around that. The other thing is that, yeah, I see a lot of YouTubers who will make a lot of negative reviews to establish credibility, to show that they are not bought by the man or whatever it happens to be. And I don't know. I feel differently. I think that we should just focus on the things that we like and also talk about some things that maybe need to be a warning to users and whatnot. I just released a review this morning on the MSI Claw, which I consider to be a negative review. I didn't do a clickbait title on it, but I put, MSI Claw review swing and a miss is basically what I put. And it's a negative review, but it took me three times as much time working on that one as opposed to my regular one. So I kind of dread making the negative reviews, not because I'm trying to shield something, like I said, but because I want to focus on the things that are amazing. There's too many products in the world to try to cover them all. And so I want to focus on the ones that are interesting and awesome. And it does make my channel a little bit more on the positive side, but I kind of like that too. That's what I would want to watch.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that feedback before of like, oh, okay, well, if you're focusing too much on negative reviews, then that's just, what you're known for. But also if you focus on too many positive things, then you're not getting the full breadth of everything else out there. And I think there is a lot of content that's like on one end of the spectrum and not the other. And honestly, I think, at least for me, I hate the middle of the road reviews where it's just like, okay, I don't really feel one way or the other. There's not much here that's exciting.
My RTX 3060 review headline was, it's fun.
It's like, hey, I did all this work and it's like, okay. That's, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm kind of like Russ. I try to have a more positive outlook. That's actually feedback I've gotten from several of y'all, like in comments, people reading, watching this on Twitter and stuff like that, saying, hey man, you're kind of more positive than some folks. And that's because I think even with negative products, there's times you say, if you're in this category, it could be a good fit for you. So that's kind of what I tend to lean towards. But it's weird writing a negative review. I never enjoy doing it. It takes a ton of time to make sure you're getting the right balance and delivering it in the right way. And it takes a lot of self-control to not necessarily just lay into a thing that you really dislike. You have to like step back and explain objectively why you dislike it. So it takes way more time. And as I said, I'm more of a positive person. I try to put positive stuff out there. But I find that if, at least in my experience, I've been working, 15 years now in the industry, you get a reputation, not just amongst readers and colleagues and stuff, but also with companies. So if you're going out there and putting good faith intentions out there, you're explaining, hey, I don't like it because of XYZ. I do like it because of XYZ. Over time, you get a relationship for being a straight shooter. So even if you do wind up having a negative review, I find that most larger companies at least take it in stride and usually say, you raise a lot of good points. Let us go back and look at that and come back for revision 2, kind of a deal.
Yeah, it actually brings up another point, around this whole discussion. At least the guys over on Hardware Unboxed were talking about this, like that what's the relationship between us and the companies we're getting the hardware from? Some people would say, oh, reviews are just an extension of the marketing, because they're trying to get more information out there. And then, you know, some people would say, oh, no, actually, reviews are useful items for people to know whether to buy or not. Gordon, where do you fall on? Hey, what role does reviews place? And the fact that, hey, yeah, I'm sure some companies see it as more of a marketing thing, where, you know, we might see it more as a user service thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think our job as hardware reviewers, software reviewers, whatever you want to do, you have to be fair. And our ultimate job is to serve the readers and viewers, because, you know, they're the ones that are shelling out their cash to buy the product. At the same time, you know, a lot of people get really kind of, I think they get angry whenever, you know, you even think about it, but you also have to be fair to the hardware vendor. And this is one thing I do think the internet has gotten a little too hard on. People want to see products kind of like burned, stomped on, turned over, kind of little pieces, and then everybody comes up and gets their chance to kick it. And I think that is, you know, wrong, because that toxicity is really, I mean, there are truly bad products out there, of course, but I do think people get a little too gleeful and wanting to just kind of like jump on a product and say it's terrible. So I think as a reviewer, you have to, obviously, your job is to serve the potential customer, but you have to, in that process, be fair and professional with the vendors. There are real people who make these products that they spend a lot of time working on these products. They know full well what exactly the weaknesses of it, and they know full well that it may not do really well, but you never make it personal. And that's my opinion, is you never want to make it personal, because you know what? It's just a product. If you don't like it, don't buy it. That's all you got to do. You don't have to get gleeful and laugh and shout about it and get on the internet and write 500 paragraphs about it. Just basically don't buy it. But I think reviewers also have a responsibility to be fair to the vendor. If there's a problem with the vendor, you go back and talk to them and say, hey, I've got this problem with it. What's up with this? Is this a feature or is this a screw up? So, you know, there are a lot of responsibilities anytime you review something that you should try to take as a hardware reviewer.
This whole conversation is actually making me think back to the Radeon RX 6500 XT that came out. I think it was last year, maybe the year before.
Yeah, I think
it was the
2 years
before.
2 years, I think.
And time has no meaning since 2020, my guys. But yeah, it was actually the opposite for me. I got dragged through the fire and flames, for my opinion, on the part. But for the opposite reason, the vast majority of reviews out there were very negative on the part. And understandably so. It was super cut down. Like, it had limited PCIe lanes. You could only play it at very limited settings. You needed rebar for it to work decently well, so on and so forth. And it was not an upgrade over previous generations. It was an active downgrade. I could understand why people got mad at that and why it got so many negative reviews. But from my perspective, I was saying, yes, I said all the exact same things. I said, don't upgrade to this from something else. But I know kids who've been out here during the pandemic saving up their grass cutting money and stuff and just want to get a graphics card. And there's been nothing under $300 for 4 years now. And now at least there's something under $400 that they can go buy. And yes, it's crap. It's an RX 580 5 years later, and that sucks. But it's good for something to be out there that people can actually buy new. And I got, you know, a substantial amount of feedback from that. From readers and from colleagues alike. But to me, that's kind of just the steel pants you have to have as a reviewer. And that's the kind of dedication and exhaustiveness you need to bring to your work. Like, I'm not afraid to back down from that opinion. I did a follow-up article on it explaining just that part more thoroughly, because I felt like all the points I were making were well thought out, and I could bring data and observations and say, here's why I think this. I understand why everyone else thinks differently, but I still stand behind what I'm saying because I'm not just pulling this out of my butt. And I think that's the kind of work you got to do as a reviewer.
Well, one of the questions I have, and some people would say this out here, is that people who buy it with their own money and don't actually have any interactions with the vendors is more unbiased than people who actually work with vendors. Gordon, what's your opinion on that?
Sorry, I was trying to read something in chat. What's the question again?
Some people would say that reviewers who go out and buy something with their own money and do not have interactions with the vendors, is a more non-biased review than people who work with vendors to get hardware.
I would disagree with that opinion. You know, there are times when you have to buy the product because they don't want to supply it. They may not have the SKUs you want to review, but it doesn't mean anything whether you buy it or you get seed the product. If your review with a review product before embargo is fair and matches basically most other people's reviews, then I think that's the only thing that, you know, can matter. I don't think buying it makes a bit of difference. I know plenty of reviewers have tried that over the years, thinking like this is going to make us, you know, better, stronger than the other reviewers, but ultimately it didn't make any difference at all. Because, you know, again, the nice thing about working the hardware side, you know, we're not doing movie reviews, which are completely subjective. You review hardware, you run benchmarks, you look at power, you look at these things, your criteria. As long as you're consistent with your previous reviews and your world view of hardware, I think people can agree that's better than, you know, just this arbitrary of like, oh, I bought the product. We know that doesn't mean anything, because there are cook people who will buy the product just to basically say crappy things about it. And is that any better? You know, I would say no, because maybe they're not being fair to it. Maybe they're ignoring data that they should have used in the review. So I think it's pretty ridiculous. I think it just comes down to the actual reviewer. And this is a classic example. You don't really need to pay attention to the outlet that it's from. You should only care about, I trust this person. You shouldn't trust the outlet. You should trust the person. There are some trust that goes into the outlet, because clearly if that person has worked there for a long time, then that probably means something. But generally, your loyalty to a review should be with the person, right? You like the way MKB does his reviews, then, and you trust it because it's worked for you in the past, then, you know, go for it.
That is a good point to bring up, and something that I know I appreciate as I'm early on in my, you know, kind of reviewing and benchmarking journey, is that we have a team of people, you know, that I can talk to Brad, I can talk to Gordon, I can, you know, talk to anybody on staff and be like, hey, I'm thinking about it this way. Does this make sense? Kind of thing. But then also we do have the fact that PC World is such a history brand. I actually do feel like that does carry some weight in a lot of ways. But Russ, you're kind of on the opposite end of it. You're, as far as I know, you're a one man show for yeah. your channel. And you know, you've been around for a bit, but you know, I'm not putting you down, but you know, like not as long as like PC World. Like, how do you deal?
PC World is older than I am, and I have white hair.
Yeah, true. how do you deal with that then? Kind of, you know, working on kind of the other end of it. That would scare me.
It is. It's something. It's strange, because Retro Game Core came out of also my retirement from the military. So I spent almost 23 years in the Navy. I retired as a Master Chief. And you know, one of the things that I learned in that transition out of the military and into civilian life is that I no longer have established credibility by just walking into a room. Previously, I had the uniform on, all my ribbons and everything like else like that. I walk into a room, everybody knows that I'm like the highest ranking guy in the room, or whatever happens to be, right? And so you immediately get that kind of respect and understanding that I've spent that time establishing myself. You put out a YouTube video and nobody knows you from Adam. And so all of a sudden you have to establish that credibility. And that was one of the things I learned right off the bat, was that I understood, you know, having spent 23 years with, like, you know, what we call guiding principles in the military. It's like, you know, we called them honor, courage, and commitment, like core values, you know. And so those are things that I spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about throughout my entire career. How can I do this with the most honor, credibility, and everything else? But when you try to establish that on the internet, it is a much harder thing to do. And so that was one of the things I realized right off the bat, was I needed to earn people's respect and credibility by being honest and putting all that stuff out for first. And one of those things was the transparency of getting review units for free. And there's a lot of sentiments out there, you know, that a reviewer is afraid to make a bad review because they want that gravy train of the free product, or maybe they want to make sure they get early access to that product, and that will color their review later on. But like I mentioned before, you know, the truth will always come out. And so my biggest thing was always that I am adhering to what's best for that user, that potential buyer, and making sure that I'm accurate and describing what that experience will be like for them. And whatever the company thinks about that doesn't really have much to do with it for me, other than being accurate, like Gordon mentioned. You know, I typically will only go back to a company if there's something catastrophic with the review, you know, the screen isn't working or something else like that. Then I'll talk to the company, but otherwise that's all going to be part of my review. And then I will leave them a long email at the end of it. This is all my feedback for things that I hope you guys can update in the software or whatever it happens to be in the future. And so that's typically my process for it. But yeah, it's very hard to kind of establish that credibility and whatnot. And it's been, gosh, almost 4 years now that I've been working on this channel. And so I think I've gotten there at this point where I've established my credibility. Now it's a matter of maintaining it. And yeah, the early product thing and whatnot, and buying it, not buying it, it's all the same to me. I often forget. Like I can't remember if I bought this one or if it was sent to me, because I just have a stack of them and I can't remember which one is which. And so it's always funny when people think that I'm just like a gravy train, like bought and paid for, when every time I get a new unit, I'm like, oh man, that's more work. Like that's another 40 hours of work that I just got for my free $80 like Linux handheld or whatever. And so yeah, it's funny, the interpretations of what people see on the internet versus, you know, the struggles that we go through as reviewers trying to establish and maintain that credibility.
Yeah, I don't have firm beliefs in either direction. I think both are fine. Like, it's totally fine getting review units in. It's totally fine buying your own. An amusing thing to me is people worry about bias as far as review units being sent to you. But to me, especially for smaller channels, if you just spent $700 on a laptop and that's what you make in 3 months of YouTube AdSense, like, to me, you'd possibly be more incentivized to come up with a really awesome review or a really negative review to try to turn that around. So there's pros and minuses to both. But I think the core point that I believe, and I think that you two guys just said as well, is to go out there and find people you trust. Like, ideally, if you're super, like, I'm super interested in GPUs, I could tell you, I'm not going to, because I don't want to burn any bridges, I could tell you my three favorite other reviewers that also do GPUs like me. You know, one of them tends to look in a different direction for me, and that's something I really appreciate. It's another perspective. Other ones just tend to kind of view this things the same way I do. So if I'm, like, on the edge, like, is this right? Are these numbers right? Then their review comes out and I see they found the same things. That just, you know, gives me that sense of ease. But the important part is to just find people and publications. Because unlike Gordon, I think you can look at publications. I'm slightly biased since I'm the executive editor of PC World. But like, at PC World, we spent 40 years, you know, rigorously defending journalism ethics and coming up with how to review things. So I personally feel comfortable saying, if you go and read a review of PC World, there's a lot of thought and there's, you know, no ulterior motive behind any of our reviews. But if you can find a publication that has a review writer that you really like, or YouTuber, even better, great. But the important part is to find people who you think have good ethics and who really seem to speak to you, and follow that.
Gordon, I have a question for you.
Okay.
What makes a journalist? Is Marquez Brownlee a journalist?
Yeah. You know, I actually went to school stupidly to study this, and I will say yes. You know, he is a journalist. Steve over Gamers Nexus is. Everybody, you know, Moore's Law is dead. I told him this on a show, and I believe, you know, basically anybody who brings information to readers or viewers is a journalist. You have responsibilities you should follow. Not everybody does. But yeah, I don't, there's been tension between people who are old school, you know, journalists think oh, you're a YouTuber, you're just somebody, an influencer. But there are clearly people who on the internet are influencers. As we know, sometimes they only review products that they get paid a lot of money to review. Oftentimes those products tend to get very good reviews. And there are people who, get seated units and then they go about trashing them because they say exactly what is wrong with them. The people that are doing that are doing journalism correctly are, in my opinion, journalists. I think everybody is. You don't get a license to in this country anyway, which is one of the strengths of it. But as long as you're doing it, the way that is correct for most people, and I guess for your audience is what they want, then I would definitely say yes, definitely they are.
Hmm. Yeah, because I feel like I've heard feedback in the past of like, oh, no, actually, YouTubers aren't journalists. They didn't go to school or they didn't study journalism, whatever. Like,
I didn't either.
But yeah, and like I think some people, some people would look at and assume that Gordon says, "Oh, you know what? If you're not up to this level, you're not a journalist." But you're saying actually the barrier of entry is even lower than people expect, and that everyone who is doing some sort of coverage should adhere to these kind of practices.
Yeah, no, and that again, there's many years ago there was a snobbery between written content people for large outlets and YouTubers, sort of the newcomers. I mean, there's always something. There's a rivalry between newspapers and TV stations and radio stations, different mediums. But in the end, as long as you're actually doing your job correctly and serving your audience, then you are every bit, a journalist. And again, you still have to hold them to the same standards you would expect them to. You want them to be fair. You want them to be balanced. You want to be able to get the truth from them. And if you're not getting that, go somewhere else. But yeah, no, definitely. I've never viewed YouTubers as less than what I do. In fact, there's many of them that are they do way more in-depth coverage than I am capable of doing these days. And I think that's to be respected. Obviously, when you go out and you're looking at where you're consuming it, it again matters from whom. The outlet can matter, as Brad says, although I still think ultimately it goes to the person doing the review. But I don't think anybody should think just because you didn't officially go to journalism school and work for a newspaper or a magazine that you're not a journalist. I think that's ultimately snobbery, and that's not what journalism is about. It's first person who put a cartoon on a cave wall was like a journalist, probably like, oh, great big dinosaur eating people. Although, by the way, dinosaurs and humans didn't coexist. But
so we're not going to get into that.
just breaking. Ugg was killed by gigantic Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I'm getting a report. This just in. No. So a friend of the show, Skeet Sayer, said, this conversation is not looking at NDAs. That's a good question. Do you feel like NDAs are ethical? Because you are working with that other company and saying, hey, I'm going to uphold to something that you set.
Yeah, an NDA is basically a fancy way with lawyers behind it that says there's an embargo that you agree to look at a product. Honestly, as a reviewer, I like it when there are actually set embargoes, because that means if there is 2.5 weeks to review a CPU or GPU, you have 2.5 weeks to review it. The hardest thing ever is like, okay, here it is, no embargo. Then you're just like, oh, geez. Then you're like, I got to pull a 20-hour day just to get this thing done. And that kind of sucks. So that is all an NDA and an embargo is. It's just simply everybody gets to go at the same time technically. So that's the way I view it. I don't think it makes any difference. Again, unless the NDA says, oh, by the way, don't run this, or this. Don't test this. No one would ever agree to that. Anybody who reviews hardware would never agree to that. I would hope that you would agree to not run tests. Yeah, sure, they're going to. And I've had many companies try to twist arms and say, well, you shouldn't be running this. You should be running this. And they were very, angry when we ran it anyway. And we didn't buy into their rationale. So I think it's ridiculous that anybody would do that. I've never heard of anybody doing that. I would hope they wouldn't, but I don't think an NDA makes much of a difference, because all it does is let you have a conversation with the hardware vendor, get information about ahead of time, get some of the rationale about it, and then bam, Monday. It's always Monday at 6 a.m.
Yeah, that's the worst.
I get the hope and the feeling behind that question whenever people go, NDAs are bad. It's the same thing. I understand the frustration and the hope behind the whole you should buy your own hardware thing for reviews. But in reality, I think they're actually a very good thing and lifts all boats as far as when it comes to actual coverage. Because like Gordon says, there are times when people just or companies just go, hey, here's this, have at ye. And you'll see, you know, 8,000 articles the next day that have 300 words in them that have just surface level thoughts and that say this is developing, check back later, stuff like that, because it's the race to first, because first does make a big difference. But when you have an NDA, that gives everybody usually a week or so, you know, depending on the product, couple of weeks, time to actually thoroughly poke it, sit back, think about the whole experience, not just those bits that you're coming across hour by hour, and come up with a thorough, like, here's my opinion of this, here's why. So I like NDAs. Sucks if you're not one of the NDA recipients, but
I mean, because that is potentially a way that companies can stack things, is that, oh, you know what, we know that they're gonna be a little negative, so maybe we don't give them the stuff. Could that happen?
It has happened. Go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, it has happened. And all you do is you can cover it. One time I took an approach by saying, hey, this came out. Nothing was sent for review, although I see some more out there now. You know, I would wait for independent reviews until you go out and buy this product, even though it's a big hot new thing. The fact that there's no NDAs.
Yeah, and I will say the one thing that's actually kind of nice, you know, again, about working for an established outlet is the companies, they, especially if you're known for being fair to companies, they don't freak out. They generally don't like, oh, you know what? Forget you. We're never going to send you anything again. Most of the companies understand that, you know what? You know, swing and a miss, this kind of sucked. We knew it kind of sucked, and they beat us up over this, and they accept it. And they're again, very professional about it. As long as you're professional, you don't make it personal. You don't call for people to be fired. You don't go like, this is the dumbest thing ever. I don't know what you were thinking. You must be stupid. You don't make it personal. Then they understand that you just didn't like it and it didn't work out. And hey, that's the way it breaks. And hopefully the next time we do it, it'll be better. And again, I can't think of, I mostly work for established outlets. I can't think of too many times when we got iced out of coverage. There have been times where companies clearly were pissed at us and they didn't want to send us anything, but hey, we don't care, whatever. We either go buy it or we just ignore it. It doesn't really matter. It's not a big deal. But I will say most of the time, the nice thing about working for something like BC World is they're like, okay, well, you know, that kind of sucked for us this time. We'll see it in a few months on the next product, you know, so that's actually very nice.
Well, we actually did get a $5 Canadian super chat from friend of the show, Skeet Sayer. I appreciate it a little bit ago, but I want to get to it now. And this is kind of around the same kind of thing we're talking about. So Hub did a review of an NVIDIA card, and it was not good. NVIDIA threatened to pull support. Who is in the wrong?
Well, I would say, you know, again, I think Hub did the right thing. They went exactly. I remember that entire kerfuffle. I was kind of drunk during most of it, but I will admit that. I would say they were right to go with what they said. That's what their feelings were as a reviewer. You know, they very much review for today, not in tomorrow's promises. This was over NVIDIA saying, hey, you're not running enough ray trace benchmarks. We think ray tracing is important to the future. We would like you to run ray tracing benchmarks. Hub, if I remember, was like, no, we don't think this matters one bit right now for somebody buying a graphics card. We're not going to run them. Got to a stalemate. NVIDIA basically, as I remember, said, screw you, we're not considering more graphics cards. NVIDIA, again, it's their product. They don't have to send it to anybody. They can send it to the people they want to send it to. I could have told you full well before that thing even blew up that the only way that ends was NVIDIA rolling over, and they did, because that's what happens. This has happened many times before. It's going to happen again, but you can't muscle reviewers. It's just the dumbest thing ever, because all it does is make you look weaker, and it actually makes you, if you have a good product, maybe the product wasn't reviewed the way you think it was. Trying to muscle them just makes people go like, oh, there must really be something to this review, right? So it's a PR strategy that never wins. At the same time, they do not have to send products to you. If there's somebody there at NVIDIA that gets a weed up their butt and says, you know what, screw them, don't send them another card, it happens. I've been locked out of, I'm not going to say, this is ancient history, I've been locked out of getting CPUs for a year because, you know, we blew an embargo, and another one of our competitors basically narked on us by blowing the embargo in print. So the penalty was you don't get a CPU for a year. Okay, whatever. We just dealt with it. We got CPUs different ways. But in that case with NVIDIA and Hub, it ended exactly the way we all knew it would, was NVIDIA saying, okay, we will send you the cards. And I will point out, and you know, I'm different than Brad. I'm different than a lot of other people because of previous experience in reviews. I do think there is value to future promises. I would say for most people, you can't bet on it. But if that future promise is from, you know, NVIDIA, from Intel, from AMD, and it looks like they've got a lot of momentum under it, there is realistically, it's worth mentioning. Like Arc, originally, I agreed, like most people should not buy that graphics card. But if you go back to the videotape, I also said Arc is probably the graphics card that's actually going to give you more performance. You know, a Radeon or NVIDIA card is not going to get suddenly 40% more performance as the drivers improve. But because Intel's drivers were so bad, there was a really good chance you were going to get more out of an Arc 770 than you were going to get out of the competing card. And sure enough, over time, Intel has built up the drivers to get them to where they're much faster, much more reliable. And the future promise with Arc actually paid off. Future promise with ray tracing. Ray tracing is very important to gaming today, right? 1080 Ti versus 2080. I still say 2080 was the better buy over the 1080 Ti because you could get ray tracing and get some broadcast features. So I'm much more lenient towards future promises. In that case, though, I will say they were both right. Hub was right not to back down, to change the review process. NVIDIA doesn't have to give anybody cards, and it ended up the exact way that I predicted it would, which was NVIDIA loses the PR game there, because I've seen it before, and you always lose.
This actually brings up another good point. I've chatted a little bit with Russ about this. Are day one reviews like a bad thing? Because we've seen it time and time again where a product, it will get a ton of day one coverage and the narrative is out there on whatever it is. And then maybe 3, 6, 9 months later, it's actually could be a different product. Maybe it's worse or better, depending on what happened. Like, are we doing a disservice to people by only really focusing on day one coverage? Russ, what are your thoughts on day one versus
taking your time with
something?
A perfect example, and I keep going back to it, my MSI Claw review. I mean, this is a late review, right? Like a lot of the reviews came out 6 weeks ago, and I bought mine 6 weeks ago, but then also my family went on vacation for spring break. We went to Japan. And so I missed that timeline where someone would have released those reviews. And we got a lot of great reviews that came out at the time. And so I decided at that point, well, I can't really jump on, you know, a week later and saying, hey, you know, this is also bad, like everyone else just said. Let me wait and see if the software updates will make some sort of update to it and change the experience. And then I'll make a review at that point where I have something new to say, something that's different from the rest and whatnot. And so that's what I did. I waited and I got like 3 BIOS updates, 4 GPU driver updates. And then I made my review video. And it's funny. I've gotten a mixture of reactions to that. Some people are saying, oh, well, it's great that you lived with it for that amount of time to be able to give us a new perspective, something that's different. It's not just a day one review of this thing is terrible, but more like I've been trying to get this thing to work and this is where I'm at. And then others have said, well, you did a disservice to all of us because you should have told us it was terrible on day one and then done another video later on to tell us, oh, now it's better. And so it's a lose-lose, you know, where I found that I can't really get the right mix in terms of the timing and also being, I don't know, like honest with the reviewer in terms of, or with the audience in terms of what that experience is going to be like. And I took a gamble on this one. I said, you know what? And some of it had to do with the fact that we were on spring break and I didn't have a choice, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a later review this time. Instead of just coming out the gate and saying, this is terrible, don't buy it. Let's see what Intel does with all this stuff in terms of GPU driver updates and whatnot, and how that experience is going to be. And it still ended up being a negative review, but it was one that I feel is more informed because of hindsight and the time that was involved in testing it. And so, yeah, it's hard. You know, you see this YouTube pattern very often. I've been watching it where an initial review and then, hey, 3 months later, you know, that kind of thing as well. And so I don't know. I don't want to make multiple videos on a product. I want to make sure I've got an informed decision and then I can wait for the right time. And for me, the right time was 6 weeks later with the MSI Claw.
But I think that's great. I personally think that's great. I love that both types of these exist. I don't think day one reviews are bad whatsoever. I actually am a big believer. I push people to hit embargoes when we're covering big products here at PC World, because if something is big enough to have an embargo with multiple outlets, that means there's probably some public interest. And I think there's tons of value to be had in having independent, you know, long-term reviewers having their evaluations up the day that you can go buy this stuff. Like, if we got rid of day one reviews, a lot of people would get stuck with a lot more lemons and it would suck. But I'm a huge fan of the videos and the articles that go back and say, okay, this was rough at launch. Let's take it up 3 months, 6 months later. Like, they're both incredibly valuable to me.
Which the follow-up question I have, Brad, on the website, how would you handle that? Would you go back and actually re-edit or edit a review, a day one review, to give that updated information? Or is that a separate article? I mean, obviously on video form, you can't go back and change the video. So usually it's, you know, a follow-up video, but what about on the written side?
Fortunately, this is something that doesn't come up very often. Typically with PC gear, the stuff you get on day one, yeah, there'll be differences, updates that improve performance, but typically, you know, 6 months later, it's still largely the same experience. Intel Arc GPUs being one noteworthy differentiator recently. We have a policy of not going back and changing our day one reviews. If we were going to reevaluate something after 6 months, something like that, we would run a separate review or feature of some sort and then go back into the original review and link, hey, we just tested this right at the top. 6 months later, a lot of this is no longer applicable, so go check that out instead. And I like companies that give you a built-in news reason to do that. Like, AMD is very smart about it. Like, once a year, they'll release their big AMD Adrenaline update that adds all kinds of new features and stuff. But they will also bake in all kinds of performance improvements tied into that. So, you know, you have the reason to go and look at all the new features, but also go back in and benchmark all of these things again. And there's a topical reason to go back in and re-explore it. And I like it when companies do stuff like that. I think Intel's doing a great job with the Intel GPUs, you know, keeping us updated and how things are going. We've done a bunch of reevaluation videos of that. Sounds like the MSI Claw could be, you know, a good candidate in the future. But we have a policy of not changing our day one impressions. It's different for software. Like, you know, if we're reviewing Norton 360 Deluxe, we'll just overwrite the one from 2 years ago because that's not even available anymore. So.
Interesting. Okay. I know we've gone round and round a lot of this. I want to be cognizant of the time. Is there anything else in this space we want to cover that we haven't already? Obviously a lot to cover, but.
Well, I do want to point out it'll be interesting to hear your perspectives on blind spots. All reviewers have blind spots, you know, and again, we view products, we still run benchmarks for products where you can run benchmarks, but if for MKB, it feels like, and so has he crossed the line into becoming a harsher reviewer? Because, you know, most of the reviews, especially when you get an audience that large, they're not looking for somebody just to scream into the microphone all night. And I wonder, and this is, I brought this up in our chat yesterday. So obviously he's come out and he says the Humane Pin is the worst product ever. That's the headline on it. Is he going to be held to that same standard going forward? Because the Humane Pin definitely was like, I'm not going to spend $700 on that thing. But the video he did on it afterwards was from the inside of a Tesla Cybertruck. And the Tesla Cybertruck has gotten nothing but bad publicity over the last few weeks. You know, like people's trucks shorting out because they go into a car wash, rust problems. And I guess, of course, recently the accelerators, they have to like
recall,
do this hoopty, you know, patch on the accelerator by just like pop riveting the thing to the floor. It's like, so are people going to go like, well, it feels like you went really hard on Humane Pin. Are you going to go just as hard on when you actually do your formal review on the Tesla truck? Because, you know, I will say he's been driving it a lot. He's been showing in his videos. And he did show that, like, oh, by the way, the door wasn't working right, so we had to duct tape the latch. There's like a, you know, there's a latch that the door holds onto. They had to duct tape that to the frame of the truck. So now that he went so hard at Humane, does he have to go hard at Tesla? Which clearly he's a big car guy. He's a big Tesla fan. Does he have to be as equally negative? Because clearly they've had a full recall on these things. They've been cutting prices. Again, I'm mentioning all these other kind of problems. Are people going to go like, wait a minute, why aren't you going that hard on Tesla now? You went really hard on Humane. I expect you to be just as hard on the Tesla truck. Do you think that's he's going to be held to that standard now?
I don't. They're two different products. I honestly have Marquez has been around forever. I trust his opinions, and for him to explain and speak out his opinions of why he likes or dislikes something. I think that's part of the reason this caused such a big stir. I don't think it's that he's necessarily trying to be negative forever going forward or anything like that. It's just that he's been speaking so long with such clear-eyed honesty that for him to say, this is the worst product I reviewed, that's why it made a stir. The fact that it's an AI pin, you know, just is kerosene on top of that. But I trust, at least right now, I trust Marquez's video to be just as, you know, detailed and explanatory as the rest of them. And I would be surprised, honestly, if the Cybertruck gets as negative a review as the Humane Pin, because the Cybertruck does indeed have a lot of issues, but it doesn't seem like an unmitigated disaster on the level of the Humane Pin. So I don't think it's fair to try to apply one to the other.
Okay.
We'll see when his review comes out.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like there's a threshold where the negativity outweighs the positivity for him. And I assume that because he's been using the Cybertruck for so long, it's going to become a positive experience, even, you know, in light with all those negatives that I think are coming out. It's really, yeah, I agree with you within the blind spot piece, you know, and what appeals to him as a human being as well, because we all have our own natural like excitement about certain products and whatnot. You know, if I was sent a mini PC that had a ton of awesome features, but then also a full size PC with a ton of features, I would be a lot more negative with a full size PC for nothing that has to do with a full size PC, just from the fact that I don't have the space for a full size PC. I like mini PCs. And so there's those kind of biases in there as well. And yeah, maybe he spent a lot of good time with the Pin review talking about how a phone can do all those things so much better. And he's a phone guy. And so I can see where, yeah, there may be potential blind spots where he's just got I don't want to say the word bias, but he just has a preference towards certain experiences. And that's what he's trying to convey. And yeah, I don't see him being negative all the time. It would just happen to be that, yeah, it was a little bit more negative than normal. And I think that's what really kind of sparked that. And then, like Brad said, you know, the whole AI bubble as well.
I don't think there's really a big controversy. I just think it was a handful of AI bros with 200,000 followers apiece on Twitter yelling about stuff.
Yeah, and they, I mean, they got, yeah, I think the popular term the kids use is ratioed because, you know, he's got 18 million people who love what he does. So people were like, no, you're wrong. But there, I definitely saw some people, they wanted to kill the messenger, as the old saying is, because they really blamed him for tanking Fisker, which is unrealistic, and then also for Humane. So it'll be interesting what happens, though, like as these startups, like, are they going to go like, well, maybe we shouldn't see them to people with that much power, you know, or that much reach? You know, you go to, I wonder if PR strategies will be to try to stick to people who they think they're going to get more positive reviews out of. It'll be interesting to see what happens after this. So
I think the better takeaway, if I was running a company, would be don't release things that aren't ready, especially after you raised $250 million, and don't send it to the Wall Street Journal and Marques Brownlee if it's clearly still a beta first adopter kind of product.
yeah.
Good point.
And, you know, I mean, the Wall Street Journal doesn't really go hard at products, but they slagged it too, right? I mean, there was like,
They do a good job of keeping the, like, every person's perspective. So.
Yeah.
Yes, they slammed it. Everyone slammed it.
We do have a couple super chats before we move on. A friend of the show, Mike Quinton, gave us $20. Thank you so much. Said, awful to follow a product recommendation that's bad and there's no one to call. Customer service should be tested as well. Vote with your wallet, but they've already got your money. How do we cover situations like that where it's like, oh, okay, well, the product might be one thing, but then the customer service is crappy to deal with. Do we factor that in?
We haven't, you know, tackled that aspect so much. That actually takes a whole lot of money and time and resources, because it's not just something you can say, hey, I'm going to call this one company once and try to go through here. Like, to try to get an honest opinion, an honest evaluation, it would take a lot. And frankly, we don't have the staff to do it.
I don't think anybody does anymore.
No, yeah. I think PC Mag does it. I think Laptop Mag might do it. I know Gamers Nexus does the occasional one. That's an area where I think it would be great if there was more coverage on that, because, you know, RMA and warranty support is actually like part of the reason that I supported EVGA up until the point that EVGA got out of the game. But it's not feasible even for fairly decently sized sites like us.
Yeah. And then also, if you really think about it, as you said, I think, although a little understated, if you're trying to do it accurately and in a repeatable manner, and again, we all live for repeatable benchmarks. If you're trying to benchmark the customer service, and by the way, you called on the day where you got the customer support person who was the D-minus person or had a really lousy day and it's just not giving you good service, how do you judge that? You know, it feels like you need to call at different times, different days, multiple times to do it in an actual scientifically repeatable manner that you want to go out and slag somebody's customer support. So I think it's very difficult. I guess you could say like, well, there's no way to reach a human. By the way, that's the situation the entire world is, from cell phones to your cable provider to people who originate your mortgages. There's nobody answering phones anymore except at the places where you pay a crap load of money. So if you pay, again, internet would call it an overpriced PC, you are paying for those so-called overpriced PCs that are very expensive because, by the way, they pay people to give you concierge service because they know there are very, very rich customers that they need to kiss their butts to get them to come back. So maybe if you want good service, you shouldn't really complain about the overpriced, expensive, high-end boutique PCs that are out there, because you really do get that service from them that you're not going to get from an OEM or most much large-scale SIs.
Coffee says, Gordon, are you talking about Apple?
Their retail service really does give a very good impression for them. Obviously, there are weaknesses to that, but there is something to be said for being able to walk into the store and have a person that is going to look at it. I guess that works for some people, but again, you know, Apple products are not cheap, and you're paying for that customer service. You're paying for somebody to stand at that desk to wait for you to come in. So there is a positive to it. So you just got to pay for it. You can't just scream on the internet like, oh, I could have built it for $400 less, and customer support and warranty and all that stuff. So,
yeah. Well, Russ, I feel like at least in the handheld space, I've seen plenty of chatter of people saying like, oh, hey, I got a handheld from X, Y, and Z Shenzhen-based company, and I had horrible problems with customer service. How much do you factor into your coverage around that kind of stuff?
Yeah,
Have you seen that? I guess
all the time. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I good 50% of my content is going to be those cheaper Chinese-based handhelds that are bought through AliExpress or directly from a retailer, which is really just kind of the same kind of experience. And yeah, customer service is going to be rough for that. They don't have the staff for that. There's a language barrier, all those things that kind of come through it. And what I typically will do is if I do like a roundup video or I'm talking about how to buy these things, I will spend a segment talking about, hey, don't get your expectations too high on this, because, you know, if something goes wrong, you're mostly going to be on your own. And, you know, these are cheap little handhelds and often things will go wrong. And so I kind of walk through that. Another thing I will do is I'll wait until they are drop shipped onto Amazon, usually with like free shipping and Prime and all that stuff. And so then I give people a choice. I'm like, okay, you can get it on AliExpress for $40 or $60 on Amazon, but now you have like effortless returns if something goes wrong. And so those are some of the premiums you have to think about when you're buying one of these cheap things. And so, yeah, I totally get that. And I probably see that more than people who are buying, you know, the name brand items, just because they're very nascent companies who just don't have the staff to be able to deal with that, or they never have before. And so, yeah, I get all that stuff, and it's very hard to try to, I don't want to spend, you know, an hour of every review talking about how terrible it'll be if something goes wrong, but you do need to give people a fair warning too.
Okay. A couple more super chats. $4.99 from a friend of the show, Joseph Ruski. Thank you so much. Said Gordon, loving the DS9 outfit on the Defiant Bridge. Perfectly ethical. So there you go.
The best of the three series.
There you go. In front of the show, Coffee gave us $6.99 Canadian dollars. That's at least 200 US dollars in my math. Thank you so much. Said, if reporters can't tell us a product is crap, then journalism is dead.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should. That's, you know, ultimately you should be able to say what you think. And that's why, again, we're talking about this because I think, you know, Marquez did nothing wrong with his review. Yeah, maybe there's a little bit of a inflammatory headline, but that's accepted. So I think we're basic. I would say he did nothing wrong, and I would defend what he did. So
okay,
if it's an inflammatory headline, that's not a wrong headline. It's the truth of what it is. I don't consider it a bad headline.
Right. Speaking of inflammatory, let's talk about mini PCs. This inflames.
Yeah, those get hot.
This flames right. A lot of people. well, actually, you know, we're transitioning to a more lighthearted topic now. the mini PCs. I guess my first question is, Russ, you know, you're in this space. You've covered a lot of mini PCs. You're going to start doing some mini PC coverage here on our channel. What constitutes a mini PC? I guess what's your definition of it?
Right. I guess for me, it's either something that runs with an APU, so it doesn't have a dedicated graphics card, or if it does, then it's got to be like pre-built, small, like something that comes in a complete package, and it's not, yeah, like not a small form factor where you can replace it, like user replaceable, but more along the lines of just a box. So you're buying a box that's pre-made, and you know, like if it can fit under a TV, like if it's consoleizable, that's a big thing for me. And yeah, that's kind of the thing for me.
Well, and I think a lot of people would ask, okay, the follow-up question, especially for us, I mean, we have a lot of people who are into building their own and all that kind of stuff. Who is a mini PC for?
So it's funny because the reason why I cover them is because they interest me, because I have the need for them. So I'm here in the studio right now. I got plenty of space, but in my house in Hawaii here, there's six of us living in this house. We are packed in like sardines. And so at the start of 2020, I built my own PC, just a smaller one, you know, but it was a full, you know, did the whole GPU thing and whatnot. And I should admit that I'm primarily a Mac user. I've been a Mac user for
okay. We're going to wrap up the show here. Thanks for coming on. I'm just kidding. joke.
Yeah, I think with a lot of other people, I got really into this idea of PC gaming. I've been a console gamer forever, and I was like, man, I really want to try this stuff out. It's, and then also strikes. Emulation.
Yeah, oh, two strikes. Yeah, yeah. Console gamer. Oh, my gosh. That's okay. Gordon's going to give you a hard time.
So I was the perfect person because I bought a full-size PC, and I only had one spot to put it in. It was underneath my desk, kind of by my feet. And in Hawaii, things are hot, right? It's hot out here. And so I was having all this warm air blowing onto my feet, and it was terrible. I like hated the experience, and I was like, I don't even want to turn this thing on because it's just getting in the way of my enjoyment of it. You know, I tried all sorts of things, and then I heard about like mini PCs and whatnot. And so I picked one up on Amazon for cheap, like $100, $150 or whatever. And it just became like a little magical wonder box where it was like, I can't believe this little thing can do so much. It's not going to do the same as my other stuff, but it just hit this threshold for me where it was kind of sparking joy. And so that's what really got me into it. It was the idea of having something that I can just put on my desk and can still give me performance that's good enough in some contexts. And so that's really what I started to push for. And not the idea of making the most powerful thing in the world that can cover every game in the world, but how far can we push these things and what kind of extra context can we do? Can we put it under a TV? Can we load a Linux-based operating system on it, turn it into a console, things like that?
Here's a good question. It's not a question. I'm going to put it as a question. Is a Raspberry Pi based system a mini PC? Would you consider it the same thing?
Sure, absolutely. It's an SBC, you know, so a single board computer, just a lot less powered, obviously. And it's, I would even argue there are some Android boxes that can be dual booted into Linux as well. I would consider that to be a mini PC too. It's using, which essentially is just a mobile chip, you know, an ARM-based chip, but all the same, if it's giving you a PC-like experience, you know, you can run Botasera or Emulek or something else like in that, all these Linux-based retro gaming distros, then yeah, totally.
We have a question from a friend of the show, Zodwraith. Just giving me a hard time. Mac and a mini PC user, do you not like to play games? But
yeah,
I mean the Mac side, whatever. But the mini PC stuff, I mean, a lot of this stuff, just like handhelds, is changing rapidly. I feel like the mini PC space is definitely changing rapidly, you know, within the past, you know, 3, 4, 5 years as APUs have getting more powerful and stuff like that. And while it's easy to kind of thumb up your nose at you know, dedicated graphics stuff like that, or I'm sorry, integrated graphics, I mean, you can still get some good experiences on these mini PCs.
Oh,
right?
Sure. Like, especially last generation, like 7000 series Ryzen APUs, like the 7840HS, for example. Find a game that won't play on it, because every game will play. It's going to be, you know, 720p maybe in some aspects, whatever. But all the same, it's pretty amazing where we've come just from the very first days of my first mini PC to now. And so it is a strong argument for me that, you know, you could spend $700 on one of these mini PCs, the higher end, and they're going to be able to play most PC games. And for many people outside of the specific core like PC gaming space, that's going to be good enough. And so that's always been the really compelling thing for me, is this idea of where is that threshold? What's the good fit for you? Because you may not need a full tower. A mini PC might cover all your needs. And sure, it's not going to be as easily upgradable or anything else like that. But I don't know. They got some pretty cool specs on them nowadays with like Oculink ports. So you can get like PCIe graphics speeds with an external GPU, you know, USB 4. There's a lot of different things that you can do with these that really make them kind of innovative for me.
Yeah, yeah. And funny enough, I mean, some of them are upgradable in more ways than even a Mac, right? I mean, being able to switch out RAM, right. SSDs, all that kind of stuff, and then, yeah, expandability and ports. I mean, this plays a little bit in handhelds as well, but how much value do you place in expandability for these kind of mini PCs? Or do you feel like most people are just going to buy what you get and then and not really touch it?
Yeah, I don't put a lot of time and effort into that. I'll do a teardown unless it's got like liquid metal cooling, then I'm like, I'm not going to touch it. But I will pull it apart as much as I can to see it. Yeah, it's easy to get into the RAM. It's easy to change out the SSD. And I kind of leave it at that, you know, because many times the SSD access is a big deal because people will just pull out the Windows one and they'll just put a new Botasera one instead. And so they'll have like a Linux distro that they can put in there, or they'll reflash or things like that. And so access to the hard drive is a big deal. Everything else, yeah, it's just mostly going to be whether or not you can get to the RAM. And yeah, for the most part, you can. So.
Now, Gordon, you're very well known on this show for being a power user, loving a drag race kind of machine. Do you have any interest in mini PCs? And if so, what are those kind of interests?
I have interest in it because I think it's a fascinating category. It's not going to be my primary machine for a desktop, but I am always, you know, the reason why I like laptops is because you're so constrained and it forces all the vendors to do things differently. And I sort of see the same thing with mini PCs because now they make design decisions that sometimes they're really cool and sometimes they kind of suck. So I think it's a fascinating area, even though personally it's not my cup of tea for a desktop. I like discrete graphics and big ass cases, but you know, small PCs are cool. I really dig them for the engineering decisions that everybody makes. It's like a limited class in racing. You have certain rules, maybe a certain, you know, volume you have to hit, maybe a certain cost. And to me, it's really neat how some of them are doing it. I'm interested to see the coverage because I'm wondering what the trends are. Are they mostly mini ITX? How many of them are, you know, socketed parts, or are they all basically BGA soldered down CPUs, APUs? And then how many of them are using, you know, soldered down RAM? I guess are they mostly using SODIMMs?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, Russ, what do you feel like the trends are right now in the mini PC space?
Yeah, you know, some of the bigger companies in the mini PC space are like Minis Forum and B-Link, and they tend to push things mostly with peripherals, not necessarily with the specs themselves in terms of, you know, the CPU is going to be like built in, soldered in like that. But the RAM is typically going to be user replaceable. It's a lot like a laptop. You know, I think that's probably the best analogy there. It's the laptop minus a battery, screen, and keyboard when it comes down to it. And you're just going to be placing it on your desktop only. And for me personally, I don't have a need for laptops for the most part. I don't need that portability aspect to it. So, yeah, there's some trends that we're seeing. Like for Minis Forum in particular, they just released a tablet PC, their first ever. And so it's very similar to all the other mini PCs they've made, but just a different form factor. And it happens to have a touchscreen as well. And so I do see them kind of trending in other areas where there's a gap. You know, a lot of people have been waiting for good tablet, you know, for a while. You've got the Surface tablets, but those aren't really gaming oriented. They have the Asus ones, which are exorbitantly expensive for most people. And so this is kind of that middle ground where somebody could get a good like Ryzen 7000 chip, or actually 8000 chip in this one, and still have that tablet like experience too. And so I did a pretty positive review on that one. It just came out about a week ago. I see this kind of moving towards more pushing the ports and what kind of access you have to it, Oculink, things like that, as opposed to user replaceable CPUs, things like that. I don't see that happening. I think people just want something that's kind of pre-built.
And you mentioned Asus, and actually they ended up buying the Nook business from Intel.
Right.
Apart from that, I feel like mini PCs is kind of an area where they're getting a little more traction. So I feel like even bigger companies like that are kind of exploring that space. But I think some of it is regional based. You know, like I feel like I do hear a lot of people in like Asian countries where mini PCs are way more prevalent than the US. Do you think that just boils down to space constraints, or what do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I see two different trends. One absolutely in Asia, it's a space constraint. And then in Europe, there's a big demand as well. And it's a power constraint. So they're looking at these things that only are pulling, you know, a quarter or a fraction of the power out of the wall, as opposed to a full desktop PC. And, you know, with energy crises and things like that popping up over the past few years, that's been a big deal. And so I've seen a lot, the bigger customer bases have typically been in Asia as well as Europe for the most part, which is really kind of interesting.
I'm actually going to later this year switch to a mini PC for my full time, you know, work.
Nice
schedule.
Really?
Yeah, I might be surprising y'all. I have been working off of a laptop since my house burnt down in June. I don't have enough room in the space to get set up properly. I'm going to be setting up an office soon when my daughter moves out. But I have noticed it's a different house, so it's not apples to apples comparison. But my old desktop had, a Ryzen 1800X water-cooled and a 3080 Ti and overclocked and all that kind of stuff. And at my last house, my power bills were around $130 to $150 a month. was coming here and switching to my laptop, I'm doing pretty much all the same stuff I would do at the last house, aside from having moved to this laptop. And it's brought my bills down $50 a month. So to me, that would be worth investing a couple hundred bucks in a very simple, you know, under the monitor kind of thing to do my basic, you know, running the site kind of work.
Well, but why not dock your laptop? I think there are a lot of people in the chat who are like, well, some of these are getting into the price range of a laptop. Why not just get a laptop?
Rather than figure out the dongle life, I'd rather have a mini PC with like an HDMI and a DisplayPort and stuff like that, and just something I can go boot up.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, and once again, I feel like a lot of this is depending on...
Also, mini PCs are like the size of a deck of cards, a little bit bigger. A laptop is much bigger to have left on my desk.
True. Yeah.
That's a good question, though. Would you consider the original sort of NIP, like 4x4? Like, I mean, those are obviously mini PCs, but are a lot of the excitement these days is actually built around sort of mini ITX motherboards, you know, like, or maybe 8x8, not a 4x4 kind of small computer, Russ?
Yeah, I've seen it kind of go both ways. For the most part, as long as it's staying within a smaller sphere, I think people are happy with it. I think 4x4 is probably the ideal size for most folks. I don't really see things getting much bigger. There are some that are they do have external graphics cards, but they are vertical mini PCs, and so they kind of stand up on their own. They look a lot like a laptop, to be honest, like a docked laptop at that point. And so I'm not really too interested in that size, just because it just seems like it takes up more space, even though it is a vertical kind of space that is taking up. I'd rather have a little hockey puck just sitting right there on my desk. I like that.
And what kind of things would you say that people look for in a mini PC? Obviously newer chipsets and stuff like that, or actually I was looking at the IO Neo, what was that one that looks like an old Mac?
They have the AM01 and 02 are the two that have come out with. One looks like an NES and one looks like a Mac.
And I looked at the hardware configurations, and I think there was two CPU options. One of them was a 5700G, right? And then the other one was a 2500U or something like that. And right. I'm like, oh my God, that's real, real low ancient power. Like, yeah. who would want that? But I mean, they're offering it for a reason. Like, why have something so old?
Yeah. So a lot of it comes down to the emulation scene, right? So a lot of these APUs do just fine when it comes to emulating. It's more CPU intensive task. And so often, if you can get a mini PC, and a lot of them will go on sale on Amazon during, like, you know, Cyber Monday or whatever, get it for $200, and then you load that up with everything up through like PlayStation 2 or whatever, put that underneath your TV, all of a sudden you've got a retro gaming console for $200. And so there's a value there. And I think a lot of people, I spend probably 2/3 of my testing with emulation as opposed to PC gaming. And so that's usually going to be the target audience. People want to play indie PC games or retro game emulation with at a cheaper budget and not have to deal with like docking a handheld or something else like that instead. And so that's one of the things I've definitely seen, is there is a market for that really low end stuff. And it's more about the value of what you can emulate on it for that price point.
Now we talked earlier about the Intel Nook. Have you ever looked at any of that line previous to Asus buying that division?
No, I hadn't. Mostly, you know, the prices are fairly high on that. I think a lot of that comes down to that customer support aspect, which these other companies are not giving you, you know. And so they've got that lower overhead, if anything. But a lot of those are not emulation-oriented mini PC boxes, which are really what I was focusing on the most. And so nowadays, yeah, I'm more interested in getting into the Intel Nook brand. I've talked to Asus about it. We just haven't really pulled the trigger on actually me starting to review some of those. But yeah, I think that there is a space for those as well.
Gordon, where do you've seen the history of those? What do you think happened there? Because I mean, a lot of them had really good ideas. The Intel Nook.
Oh, with Nook, why did it kind of like fizzle out eventually?
It's transit. I feel like it's transitioning, right? Like, I feel like under Asus it is going to be a different thing, but under Intel it kind of, you know, became many different things. Kaby Lake G, and then a compute unit, and all
it
this
got
kind
bigger
of
and bigger and bigger. Yeah, I know it was. You know, Intel's one of those classic companies that has, in the past, has probably too much resources, and, you know, they have thrown a lot of things at the wall. The original Nook was designed to create a category. And Intel has done this before. They try to create categories to sell computers and different usage models. And they really, really hope that, by the way, you're going to be selling this. Nook, of course, actually worked out. But they, at one point, remember they tried like, hey, it's an all-in-one, but it has a battery. What? Yeah, like it's an all-in-one that has a battery. So you can unplug it and carry it. It's like it looked like a monitor you're carrying around your house, like a tablet. You know, and they have tried many things just to simply get categories started because, by the way, new PCs sell new are going to most likely going to be selling new Intel CPUs. Nook was designed to do that. I feel at a certain point they cross that line and there just wasn't enough money to be made on it, and all the partners were already making, you know, it had entered the space. So they just probably said, you know what, this is not worth doing on our own. We'll just let the partners handle it. They're doing pretty well. So I think that's what happened with Nook. And of course, that whole weird kind of card thing and all these kind of interesting side journeys that Intel took on, I'm not sure lived to the original. But again, they were trying to build new usage categories for their CPUs jammed into unusual computers. But to me, what's interesting is, even though Intel invested a lot of this and really did help kickstart the category, it looks like a lot of the excitement with mini PCs, especially in the enthusiast space and among gamers, is all AMD, right?
AMD and ARM. That's the funny part. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, and again, that's actually, you could probably say that's a good thing because, look, Intel invested tens of millions of dollars to build this category. By the way, AMD is really, really, you know, they're benefiting from all of the money and engineering that Intel has put into this. So, you know, that actually is a good look. I know people are like, ha ha, you did this. But, you know, again, they built a category up, you know, may the best hardware win. And right now for emulators and gaming, that's going to be APUs from AMD, right? So that's a good thing for everybody.
Yeah, well, and I mean, this, once again, this plays in the handheld space as well, but we're, Russ, right now, where do you see Intel playing? Do you feel like in the future they have a chance with what they're working on now, or do you think AMD is just, it's going to be dominant for a while?
You know, I honestly, and this is my Mac user showing, but I don't think I have the knowledge to be able to predict what they're going to do. But I can tell you that I can hope that they're going to be competitive because I love competition in the space. It's going to drive innovations. It's going to drive down prices. And so, yeah, I hope they keep sticking with it and keep pushing it. You know, the MSI Claw is the first big Intel handheld. I'd love to see more. I'd love to see this kind of get pushed, you know, generations beyond. And so, who knows how it's going to be, but I feel like they've got the pockets to do it. And this is a growing audience. And so I do think that between mini PCs and handhelds, which both kind of benefit each other, and I think laptops are within that space as well. As long as that whole platform just keeps getting pushed, then we're all going to benefit from it.
Nice. I dig
it. I think Intel, I'm really intrigued to see what Intel does with their next generation of mobile chips. Because Meteor Lake just came out and its whole existence is basically to make the Lego-like mix and match tiles become reality. They're getting the bugs out, blah, blah, blah. But we were talking with Tom Peterson, the Intel graphics guru. I'm not sure what his title actually is. Over there at Intel. And he was saying, hey, you know, once we get this under our belt, you can imagine, like, we can scale up. We could have, like, you know, just 4 CPU tiles, but we could put, like, 15 Intel Arc tiles in there and stuff like that. So once, you know, they get this first gen Meteor Lake, you know, done and out of the way, I'm really intrigued to see what Intel does in the future. They could fall on their face, they could stay the same, but there's also a lot of potential for them to do really interesting stuff.
Yeah, Lunar Lake's actually looking pretty impressive. I didn't realize the rumors are saying that they have integrated LP5 down on the in the package, so it may be a very competitive part. I guess the question is, are they really going to want to sell it at a price that will make it work in handheld game consoles? But performance is not going to, it's not going to be, you know, AMD and Intel are going to be fighting it out here. Although, Russ, you've admitted on the record that you are a Mac user.
Don't hold it against him.
I'm not going to hold it against you. I want to rely on your expertise. Do you think Apple is going to get into handheld gaming at all, or they just can't sacrifice? They would not want to sacrifice iOS based, you know, they don't want to have anything step on phone sales or step on tablet sales. But do you think it's something that Apple might potentially do?
Absolutely not. I don't think that their ecosystem is built for a handheld gaming space. You know, the only reason that these devices are thriving right now is because of PC gaming, x86 games, you know, Steam and everything else. None of that, you know, you try to play a Steam game on a Mac and, you know, the store itself is just bare bones. And so I just can't see a market being there for a dedicated handheld from Apple at all. You know, yeah, it'll look sleek and whatnot, but what games are you going to play on it? You know, the same iPhone games? I don't know.
Angry Bird.
Angry Birds. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, Mario Run. And so, yeah, so I don't see that happening. I don't see the investment there for them. And they've created that themselves. They've made their own ecosystem and no one else has followed.
I mean, the Mac Mini though is a popular category. How do you feel like the Mac Minis compare to what's on the market right now for Windows based or whatever?
Yeah. So I actually went and I bought one of the M2 Mac Minis and did a whole video on it, $600 or whatever it was for the lowest spec one. And I did a full emulation video, like what can it do? Because there are programmers who are porting over onto Mac OS some of these emulators and whatnot. And it outclassed every other $600 Windows-based PC when it came to emulation. But then, of course, when it came to PC gaming, which is tens and thousands of games to play, it fell flat on its face. And so from an emulation specific perspective, as long as the emulator was there, and most of them were as like Xbox and PlayStation 3 emulators not existent on Mac, but most of the others are. And so everything else, yeah, absolutely just head over heels better than the Windows component. But it's the limitations of that ecosystem between the Steam games that you can and cannot play, and then, you know, the other emulators that just aren't even being developed for Mac OS. And so, yeah, it's one of those where, man, if somebody just pushed everything towards that APU, it would be amazing. But yeah, no one has.
Are you up to date on any of the newest ARM developments, like the Snapdragon X series of stuff that they're talking about? Because I feel like, you know, at least in the space we're talking about, handhelds, mini PCs, obviously they have some things to get around, but they could be competitive in the space. Any thoughts on that stuff?
It would be so amazing. Can you imagine an ARM-based handheld that can run, you know, Windows ARM, and if Windows ARM was great, and you can play your Steam games or whatever through that and have all the efficiency, the battery life and whatnot, would be just an amazing mixture. You know, there are a lot of ARM-based Linux operating systems that will work with a lot of these cheaper handhelds. You know, the problem is, you know, driver support and things like that really limit what you can get. So we're not seeing something that can compete in the x86 space from an ARM chip when it comes to those Linux-based handhelds. But if it could, it would be just kind of amazing. And I don't know, I hope that that's the future at some point, but I don't know if there is a big enough customer base to incentivize everybody to get all those graphics drivers and everything else required in order to have that experience that I envision in the future. You know, people like me and Carrie from the Fox, we can just say, oh, this is definitely going to happen, but we are in our own little echo chamber at that point. So yeah, who knows?
Well, Gordon, what do you think? You're following the Snapdragon news. You know, are you hopeful
that it'll make into a handheld gaming console?
Yeah. You know, the problems that we've experienced in the past with ARM-based devices, that this time maybe they have worked it out.
Well, they're talking up a really good game, and the gaming performance, it sounds like kind of what, you know, Apple was saying pre, you know, M series parts. So I think there is that chance that they could be sort of competitive. I mean, they'll be competitive in battery life probably, but I don't think performance, they're going to hold a candle to AMD or what Intel has coming going forward. And although that will be the interesting thing, because I do feel like handheld gaming, it's not the kind of crowd that's looking for, hey, I need 1440p at, you know, 500 frames a second, you know. So I think there's a chance to sort of level it for ARM-based handheld game consoles. But, you know, we'll have to see if it actually performs as well as they have been claiming. It's always, I'm always very doubtful of it based on previous Qualcomm parts and being disappointed over and over and over again. So maybe it'll work out, but it does look better this time. Maybe.
Qualcomm is talking like an astonishingly big game, and I'm very curious to see how it goes. because either it's true and those chips are probably going to be pretty all right, pretty awesome for a bunch of different scenarios, or there's still compatibility issues and it's just going to blow up in their face. I don't think there's going to be much of a middle ground here.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and that's part of, we are seeing a controlled marketing PR campaign, because we're seeing benchmarks that they want us to see. And again, the benchmarks are not necessarily something you should doubt, but once they actually get out in the world and people are testing everyday actual applications that everybody uses on their x86 laptops, and the things kind of like suck, then I think it, there is entirely possible that it'll end up exactly the way we've seen with the previous chips as well. So, but you know, I am hopeful that this time, maybe they will kick that football to the moon and Lucy's not going to pull it away. So we'll see.
I'm really curious to see how the graphics go in particular, because I think they really could, if they manage to hit and then generally continue with all the claims that they've been making for these Snapdragon X Elite chips, it should have very long battery life and surprisingly good integrated graphics. Like, Mark got to test out the Snapdragon X Elite platform a few weeks ago. He was playing Control on it. He was playing Baldur's Gate, and there was one other title. And he said, yeah, it was at, you know,
it was a racing game.
I think it was at 720p. It might have been 1080p. But either way, you know, games like Control and Baldur's Gate were hitting 30 frames per second, albeit with, you know, lowered settings. So if that's roughly similar to what we're already seeing in today's handhelds, but if we can get the power efficiency boost from moving to the ARM architecture, that could be exciting in the future. Lots of question marks, but a lot of potential exclamation points.
Well, here's the other wild card. What do you think NVIDIA wants to do? Because, NVIDIA, again, I know all PC gamers think, oh, they don't care about us. They like to make money off selling GPUs for gaming. They still want to dominate there. Maybe they don't need the money of it. Maybe they just, it's like, they just like to just dunk on AMD and Intel all day. But don't you think they're looking at handheld gaming and go, we got to get in here. We cannot let AMD and Intel build this into a, you know, multi-billion dollar market and be locked out of this. We got to get in here. And the best way to do that is to stomp on their heads. What does NVIDIA do here? They don't have a x86 cores. Are we going to really see them do it with ARM?
Russ? I don't think they care.
Oh, you don't think they care. Russ, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I see where Gordon's going with that, but I just can't see how they will introduce anything into the market that will be viable. And so I'd love for that to happen. Again, you know, more competition's better, but how are they going to do that?
Hey, they're in the Nintendo Switch. Maybe that's just enough.
It's true.
I think the most we would see NVIDIA do, one, because they don't care about GPUs in a $500 to $600 device. We're already not getting budget GPUs in the desktop. They're not going to care enough to invest a lot of time and money to get into, like, I love gaming handhelds. I hope they continue to grow, but they are still a niche device. Or niche, I don't know.
One of these words.
I could see them doing something if they wanted to get into it. That's like another one of those cloud gaming handhelds that doesn't really have a GPU, so you can stream your GeForce Now games to it. I could see them doing that. I could see it just like the other streaming handhelds that we've seen from like Razer and Logitech. Most people being like, you know, whatever. And so that's why I don't think NVIDIA cares will get into it.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, I can't quickly pull up the stats, so I don't have it here, something that I could reliably show. But hey, you know, if the Nintendo Switch is selling millions and, you know, of units, and more so than, you know, the Xbox or the PlayStation 5, maybe that's enough to be like, hey, well, yeah, we're already winning here. So
the Switch 2 is the real answer if that's what really happens.
Yeah,
I guess. But it just feels like, you know, NVIDIA, they like to punch their competitors in the face, and they I think part of any winning strategy is not to let your competitors develop a market and dominate it and then try to break into it. So they've got graphics cores, and I would argue handheld gaming is probably more important to them than people trying to build a $400 budget PC, because that's just not, there's really no money in there, but it definitely feels like there is money in handheld gaming. So I kind of think they have designs on the drawing board. Again, I'm just guessing here. I have no idea, but just knowing muscle memory of NVIDIA, you know, they want to do something just to mess with them. So I think they want to get in here. I just don't know how they're going to do it necessarily.
Unless
if they weren't already sold out of fab capacity or bought so much fab capacity through like the end of next year to do all the AI chips and gaming chips already, I'd be slightly more inclined to agree with you. But I think right now they're just going to churn out all the big chips that they can do.
Yeah, true. Well, and who knows, maybe this whole ARM push with Qualcomm and Microsoft gives them some sort of in a little bit later, and they're like, hey, you know what, we'll wait for you guys to figure it out, and then we'll be able to swoop in.
Yeah, you know, I will admit the NVIDIA Shield, like the desktop or the, yeah, it's like a little set-top desktop, awesome. It's like Android based, but obviously ARM, and it can run your TV apps and whatnot. A lot of people will use those for emulation because it's basically the same processor as the Nintendo Switch. And so it can emulate up to generation 6 pretty well. And so, there is a will there, but it's the Android platform that holds them back on that one. So if they get into ARM Windows, again, competition's great. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree, because that would definitely, I think Google is the one that has fumbled, ARM PC gaming that could have happened. But with Microsoft pushing so hard for, ARM, maybe it'll change things up. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Yeah. Well, we do have a $9.99 super chat from just a friend of the show, Joseph Frisky. Thank you so much. Said, Russ makes a great point. I was in the Army and my Mac Mini was easy to move around with me. Mac Mini is now my Plex server.
Nice. That's actually what I did with that Mac Mini that I bought for emulation. Turned it into a Plex server.
There you go. But yeah, anything else on mini PC stuff before we wrap it up here? No? Gordon?
Somebody asked earlier, why aren't we seeing, have you seen any mini PCs that use USB power delivery or USB-C to run them instead of using a standard DC and barrel charger?
Huh.
Yeah, so I have seen some, we were talking about this offline a little bit too, but so they're pretty low powered mini PCs, but they have some that will take in power delivery via USB-C. And some of those, hook it up to a monitor that's actually exporting out power, and you've got a pretty good combo there where it's a single cable solution, just plugging it right into your monitor from there. Hmm. But you have to remember though that most monitor outputs are not going to be super high, so they're limited to like 65 watt power entry, and so that typically will lower the power spec of that mini PC. But they're out there, yeah. There's definitely there, but we're just not seeing it yet. I think as we get stronger GAN chargers and whatnot on the market, we'll probably see more options there as well. It is going to drive up the cost a little bit because of that part, but for the most part, yeah, it's getting there.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting stuff. And once again, Russ is going to start contributing some mini PC stuff on the channel. We've got our own ideas for sure. But if there's anything you guys want to see in terms of mini PC coverage, feel free to let us know down in the comments, because it's an interesting space for sure. And I'm glad we're going to have Russ on board to kind of poke at it with a stick here and there. So I appreciate that. But we're running real short on time, but I do think we should switch over to Q&A real quick, get a couple in. We're going to limit it to a couple, but this first one is an important one. Got a super chat actually from friend of the show, Joseph Fresky. Again, thank you so much. Gave us a $19.99. I appreciate it. Always appreciate it. It says, update from your discussion last week. Asus just pushed out a BIOS update to my Maximus Z790 Hero board for Intel power limits for 13th gen and 14th gen i9 processors. We actually do have an article about this on the website, right? So this is in relation to the crashing reports of Intel CPUs. This is something we actually did talk about on the podcast, so that it would be really nice if by default these BIOSes kind of defaulted to either in Intel limits or something that wasn't quite overclocked. Gordon, do you see this as a good turn of events, or do you think this is just kind of placating what's going on?
No, I mean, clearly there is a need for it. As Will has said I don't know, 195 times, he would like baseline settings, especially when you're troubleshooting issues that you're having with a chip that he's had many problems with. So it is a good idea that they're doing this. But, you know, I will say it immediately turned into exactly what I thought it would. You know, they came out with the baseline, and then, of course, people tested it and said, look, you're giving up 10% performance by running baseline Intel settings versus the sort of default out-of-box ASUS settings. So now it's turned into bad PR because, like, oh, my God, you're giving us baseline and it's underperforming, you know, out-of-box stock by 10%. So it would be nice if people could understand, like, the baseline is there for some people, and maybe you can run stock, hopefully reliably, for these boards. But I understand why there was hesitancy to probably to do it, you know. So, but it is good because clearly there is demand for it, and hopefully it helps some people.
I missed the conversation last week, but I'm hoping two things come out of this ordeal. I'm hoping that Intel starts to realize, hey, man, they're hammering power way too hard on these, especially on these chips, especially once you toss them at the motherboard vendors who crank them even further. Like, these Intel chips are just power guzzlers. It's insane. But two, I hope that this new Intel baseline spec just kind of sticks in the future, because this is clearly a bit of a mess. But if that spec stays as a default option in future motherboard rounds for future generations, I think it will have been worth it.
Well, and I've definitely seen people say, hey, listen, for things like XMP and Expo, which are technically overclocks, you have to go in and enable them, right? Why not do that for the rest of the power delivery, the voltage, all that kind of stuff? Why not default to the standard and you go in and overclock it yourself?
I agree. I like that. That's the way I think it should be. I can also see the argument behind, you know, hey, you're paying $700 for a ROG Maximus high-end motherboard. I just want it out of the box tuned to kick as much ass as possible. So I can see both sides of that. But I wish there was a more elegant way to let people choose which option they want.
Yeah, and there's definitely, I think what they want to avoid is you get your brand new machine, you build it, you post it, you install Windows, and then you run, you know, a benchmark, and you're like, hey, my performance is low. Why is my performance so low? We see that all the time on the internet. People just don't understand, like, maybe out-of-box is lower. So that could end up being a support call. That could end up being that person returning a part, the motherboard. So I think most of the motherboard vendors have unfortunately been trained to, like, these people want performance. They buy a performance board with all this RGB and bling on the board, so we're going to give it to them. And sometimes it results in problems. So, but I do understand why they have opted for high performance settings, and apparently now probably too much high performance settings. Finally,
Russ, in these other spaces like handhelds and mini PCs, how much do you care about just to the wall performance, or do you appreciate stability?
Yeah, I tend to err on the side of stability, so I'll push it a little bit. But I'm you got to remember, you know, I'm kind of like the new guy to the scene. So I get worried anytime I'm opening up BIOS. I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to break here? You know, and so I often will just try to trust the manufacturer and then kind of push them to be like, hey, you know, this isn't performing as well. What are you guys going to do about it? You know, as opposed to putting it back on me and seeing what I can do about it. Like, how are they going to optimize it? The Steam Deck's a perfect example. I would never want to touch any of those settings. I just want to get the latest update and I want to watch what they can do. And so I'd love to see something like that. And I think that's a different experience for handheld PCs, because I trust that they're going to look for that balance of battery life and performance, and that's what I'm looking for. And so Valve nails it. The other ones still got some work to do.
Nice. All right. It is a developing story for sure. We'll continue to kind of follow it. We didn't feel like this change warranted a full discussion or topic section here on the podcast, but we are keeping an eye on it, because I think there are some developments and hopefully some good chatter is happening and people figuring stuff out. Oh, I should mention before or after the last episode, Gordon, you wrote an article about Falcon Northwest doing some of its own testing and putting out a bunch of settings that they're trying to validate. Can you kind of get people up to speed on that article?
Yeah, so basically Falcon Northwest released last week settings that they found to address some of the chips that they have that have been unstable in their custom machines, I think. And they basically wanted to start the conversation by putting the settings out there to get people to hopefully help people and hopefully get the conversation started. And it wasn't too long after that, after ASUS actually released the baseline settings. So I think one thing that Falcon Northwest did well there was by releasing that and being public about, like, hey, if you're having problems, we're having them too. And, you know, they said, this is a real problem. You know, it's not made up. There's not just crazy people. But again, we don't know how extensive it is. But the fact that they put that information out there definitely got attention from Intel and ASUS. And I think it probably helped goad that, I don't know, but I suspect hopefully helped goad that baseline performance settings. And I think the one good takeaway from all of this is people are now working on this. I know a lot of people are upset that, like, we don't have an immediate answer from Intel about what the hell's going on, how many are affected. Is this going to be a wider problem or is this a tiny sliver problem? But I think you got to just have some patience, because trying to troubleshoot this problem is probably not as easy as it sounds, and it'll eventually come. And clearly all of these companies are working on it to figure out what it is. And hopefully we get the truth of what happened. And I think we will, because, you know, it's a public company and they're going to want to come out and tell us what the hell happened. And plus, even if they don't, their partners will tell us what happened and then we'll say it anyway. So you can't really hide it. So I think it's a good thing. And if you're having problems, hopefully other motherboard makers also adopt baseline settings. You can run baseline if you're worried about it. 10% of a really fast CPU is not a lot to live with for a few weeks. Well, hopefully this is figured out. So I think it's a good thing, basically, that everybody is really paying attention to it, because it has been going on for far longer than it should have. This has been discussed on Steam forums for months. There have been some, you know, tool developers that kind of like went public with it. And it's good that we're here. So have some patience. Don't freak out. Hopefully run baseline. And then we will hopefully get to the bottom of this within a few weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of good stuff there. We have a super chat and then I think we're going to get out of here. We have a Michael Benny. Seems to be the first time on the show. Welcome, Michael. Gave us a $1.99 super chat. Said, how is the Steam Deck and the ROG Ally as a mini PC? So I think that's a good question. I don't personally use it that way, but the idea of being able to dock a handheld, either with just kind of a dock that puts outputs or maybe some sort of external GPU option. Like, how do you use it in any form?
Like, yeah, being for able the to Steam dock, Deck
kind of stuff.
Yeah, for the Steam Deck, I'm always impressed that you can use it as a desktop, but I never do. I think most people don't. I think most people avoid the desktop version of Valve, like the SteamOS experience. But for my ROG Ally, that's actually my primary PC at the house. So I have the XG Mobile external GPU. So that is my PC. Again, small, it's not blowing hot air on my feet. It's like all the things that I need in a PC. And so I really enjoy that. And I do that in that one context. It's expensive like that. It's not a thing I recommend for other people, but for me personally, I think it's well worth it, given the fact that I can just kind of tuck the XG Mobile in a little corner of my house, plug in my ROG Ally when I need to do some like desktop gaming, but then I can obviously pull it off and use it for handheld gaming as well. It's like a Switch Pro, if you think about it that way. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You can play like a Switch, plug it in, dock it up, and all of a sudden I'm playing the same game, same save, and in 4K. And so it's a pretty awesome experience, just a very expensive one.
Well, last time we had Kerry the Fox on the show, he was talking about how his daily driver is a GPD?
Yeah, WinMax.
Mm-hmm. And like that's kind of his daily thing, and it has got me thinking. Like, you know, Brad is thinking about switching to a mini PC. I have been thinking, like, oh man, could I actually take the ROG Ally like and use that as my main desktop? I do less editing than I have in the past. Could I actually make that my work desktop experience?
I was considering the same about the Steam Deck with the dock, actually. Right. That might be what I'll end up on. Because a lot of my work is browser-based that I do for work. And what isn't, I use LibreOffice. I like the free and open one, and that's on Linux already. So I was actually thinking about making the Steam Deck, giving that a whirl as my primary.
Yeah, that's possible.
Make that switch.
It's scary. I don't know. I don't know if I could do it.
I still have a gaming PC that I can turn on and switch either the KVM, so it's a big asterisk there.
Yeah. we're lucky to have other hardware around for sure, but yeah. And Andrew Glass says, I don't think the Steam Deck can run an external GPU. Not correct. For a friend of the show, he was in the chat last week.
Brett,
yes, UFD Tech, Brett. He actually did a video early on in the Steam Deck life of doing an external GPU over the SSD slot, which, I mean, that's not a practical thing to do, but...
Madman.
Yeah, definitely a madman.
Well, speaking of handheld, while I have Russ here, question from Deotis, who can huff more handheld fumes, Russ or the reigning champion, Adam? Now, Russ, I need to know, do you sniff your handheld?
I don't. Sometimes it's an in-game, like a joke, like an Easter egg, where I will put my nose next to it, but I won't say anything or whatever. But now I know the whole vent smell thing. It's like a question I get all the time. I don't do it. Is this the question I was supposed to be waiting hours?
No. Wait, so you're saying you, oh God, Gordon, you're going to have to help me with the quote. Are you saying you didn't inhale, or you smoked but didn't inhale, Gordon? Do your Bill Clinton joke.
I couldn't inhale. I can't remember what he said.
Yeah, what did he say?
Such a long time.
Yeah, so Russ is one of those guys. He doesn't inhale it. He'll
I'm aware of it. Yeah,
I love sniffing it. I'm sorry.
Secondhand fume is basically Russ's way.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It's in the air.
Have they officially said why it smells the way it does?
No, I the only thing I've seen is Valve saying, please don't smell it. That's what I've seen from them.
MSI, I got them on video at CES saying it's okay to smell the claw. MSI said it.
I should have put that in my review.
Yeah, there you go. I still think scented thermal paste. I'm going into Computex. That's my big idea that I'm going to pitch to all the vendors. Hey, scented thermal paste needs to be a thing.
I'm so used to all new electronics outgassing that horrible electronic smell, I'm just smelling all kinds of chemicals they used to wash the board off with, and I'm just surprised it actually smells pleasant. It makes me wonder if they are actually using a scented thermal paste, like you're saying.
Maybe. I test a lot of really cheap handhelds, and there's three or four major companies, and I can tell you the smell of the factories between them. When I open up the box, I'm like, oh, that's Pow Kitty. I can tell the difference of the smell between them, which is just insane. But yeah,
that's true. Awesome.
Yeah, no, it's probably not good. You probably shouldn't do it. But for some reason, I'm addicted. I gotta
just let Adam do it.
All right. Okay. Last question. We'll get to it now that I had forgotten. But Russ here, we have a very important question. Mm-hmm. We have a long-standing debate. Hopefully you're a movie guy, so you've seen both of these. But which is the better movie, Alien or Aliens?
Oh my gosh!
think about it hard. It's okay.
Yeah, I am.
You're not going to hurt anybody's feelings. Maybe one person's feelings. But.
So Alien, definitely, because of the lore. Like the fact that you just walk in and there's the spaceman there and you're like, what is that? And they don't even explain it, right? And then all of a sudden, the innovations of having the xenomorph and the chest burster and the whole cycle of life, all of that put together in a one movie. It's not the one I would prefer to watch, I think, between the two. I think Aliens is more watchable. But Alien, the initial one, absolutely. The amount of changes and the breakthroughs of it, it's the same reason why I love Predator. It's just so many cool innovations. And so, yeah, that one wins for me.
That's three strikes. That's three strikes.
It's a very good double answer, but that's the third strike, man.
Gordon was holding back. He's like,
Well, I do appreciate that you admit I wouldn't want to watch this movie, which of course...
No, that's not what he said. He said he'd prefer to watch Aliens, not that he wouldn't want to watch Alien.
Yeah, it's more watchable.
Definitely, I think, you know... Well, I do like the way this food looks. I like the presentation, but it does taste like poo, so I think I'd rather eat this burger, but I do like the way this looked, so I guess I can agree with that.
Russ, Russ, that was the correct answer. Alien is the better movie. Correct.
Oh, yeah.
if you couldn't tell, it's you know, there's variances of opinions here. Anyway, I think we should wrap this up. We've gone on longer than anticipated, as it always does happen. Check back next week for your fix of PC talk here on The Full Nerd. To listen to us on the go, subscribe to us over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, Pocket Cast, anywhere you can point your RSS reader to, then hopefully this podcast is over on that. And if you do, if you would like to make our hearts just warm and giddy on the inside, please leave us a review on one of those services. Every time you do, we have yet another debate about Alien versus Aliens with a new guest. You know, actually, that's going to happen either way, but yes, you should please leave us a review. I want to thank everybody for coming on. Gordon, thank you for being here, as always. Please beam me up, Scotty.
AMD Prometheus will be better than Prometheus the movie.
Well, actually, that's probably true. Yeah. Brad, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Beats real work.
People saw your cat. What's the name of your cat?
That's my girlfriend's cat. Oh. I don't have a cat.
Oh, okay.
But it's a one-eyed Russian blue named Odin.
Odin. Oh, nice. That's cute. I love it. Russ, thank you so much for coming on the show. You know, longtime fan. Glad to have you on. Glad to have you in the PC world ecosystem.
Yeah, I'm honored to be here. It's my first and only appearance now that I have those three strikes, but super happy to be here.
No, it's just in Gordon's book, you know. No worries.
Don't ask the calls next to Gordon.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody out there, especially the people who gave Super Chats. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Willis, for controlling the verticals and horizontals. Let's get us out of here.
All right. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Go watch Alien and Aliens and tell us what you think. Give us give us your Aliens review of it. All right, everyone, thank you so much. Have a good day. Bye.